there are some parts of this which Christians may differ on. There are some parts of this where, as you hear and as we talk this evening, you may realize, or you may already realize, that something you might have been involved in is not really what God would want. And the purpose of this evening's talk back and talk around the topic is not to condemn anyone. It's not to kind of point out or to expose anyone in that sense. I understand that for some people this would be a sensitive topic, again, for obvious reasons. So as we speak about it, obviously as we get into the theology of it and some of the practice and some of the science, there's a kind of momentum that develops in things like this. But please hear it in that we're just humbly together trying to understand what God's word has to say to us about this topic. It's a bit boring because I always say every Tuesday that in looking at this kind of detail, it's sometimes easy to lose the gospel. We need to remember the gospel that saves us from all of our sin and all of our mistakes in this area and lots of others, and the gospel that's the ultimate reason that will turn around our culture's view on this topic. It's the gospel that will save people, and we need to have confidence in that. So, with that in mind, let's launch in. This talk back is going to finish on time. And, yeah. And Brexit will be signed in 2 weeks' time, too. And Mrs. May will be Prime Minister in 20 years' time. Let's think about the gift of medicine, first of all. So, have a little chat with your neighbour, maybe using the text that are on the handout. The handouts got a bit mangled for some reason, so some of the points repeat. So point one is the gift of medicine, although it might be labelled point five on some of your handouts, but it really is point one. Do you want another handout? There's some spares. What are you sharing? That's fine. Ruth, any more handouts would be handy? Or have we run out? Cool. Just, has anyone else not got a handout? Because the handouts would be useful. Some of the guys at the front here. Cool. Well, it'd be a shame to waste them, having printed them out. Sarah, I think, over here as well. So, have a little chat with your neighbour about medicine. So,
we said medicine is a good thing, and we looked at the passage in Matthew that talked about mercy and how it can be merciful to relieve symptoms, and it can be curative, and it can alleviate pain and suffering and distress. And we talked about how we live in a world where we are very blessed with lots of medicines, and how there are lots of countries still that don't have as many advances in medicine, even something as simple as paracetamol that can make a massive difference to people's lives.
Yeah, definitely. Anybody else want to add anything from any of those texts or any thoughts about medicine? Yes? You can ask a question, of course.
About that figs thing in Isaiah, the cake of figs,
yes.
Like, is that an actual remedy from the Bible, or is it akin to Jesus putting mud on people's eyes?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I put it in there because I thought it was quite fun. When I was about 12 years old, I had 13 boils on my body. And I was on holiday, actually. And you remember that, don't you, Stephen? It was very pleasant. 13 boils on my body. Over my body. I had some kind of problem. Anyway, and I had hot poultices put on them because my mum used to make this stuff, sort of boil it in a pot, and then you'd put it on this sort of liniment stuff, and then you'd put it on and it would like draw the pus out. So anyway, that's why I thought that one about the poultice of figs was probably a genuine sort of thing. Just saying. It's worse for my mum. She had to live through it. Any more stuff? There's loads we could say about medicines. There's more. There's more to say. What's the assumption from the text in Matthew 9:12? It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but those who are ill. What's like a fundamental assumption from that? People will get ill is a fundamental assumption. That's not the one I was thinking of, but it's a good one. Doctors can help. It's like a really useful text, just kind of a handy little text to grab hold of to say, doctors can help. Jesus reckons sick people need doctors. How does the Isaiah passage help you? Yeah, and it's the idea of binding up wounds and everything else also that's thought about in other parts of Isaiah. So whether in that one is figurative or whether in other parts of Isaiah it's talking about stuff, there's an assumption that there's medical procedures going on, and sometimes they cure, sometimes they're perhaps symbolic of a bigger cure that's coming through Jesus. But either way, medicine kind of happens and does stuff, and it's useful. What was Colossians 4:14? What do you think that tells you? Without looking, come on, tells you the profession of somebody. It's an easy one. Tells you that Luke's a doctor. So I reckon it's all right to be a doctor, or any of the other professions too. But it's good to be a doctor. It's assumed that there was nothing wrong with Luke being a doctor. It's probably useful in him writing his gospel. So in general, we think medicine is good, and it's part of God's goodness to us. Proverbs 15:13. How does that help you? Yeah, it's a really useful text for making, it basically says a cheerful heart or a merry heart in the old translation. Cheerful heart is good medicine. So it very helpfully accepts what we all really know, that there's a connection between how you are emotionally, you might say how you are spiritually as well, and how you feel physically. So that's accepted as well. So basically all aspects of health professionals' work is assumed really in the Bible. Mental health professionals, physical health professionals, it's all kind of assumed to be all going on. And trying to alleviate pain is an assumed good thing. The Good Samaritan parable is the anointing with oil of the wounds of the man who's wounded and so forth. So it's, you know, the stuff going on there. So there's all kinds of places I could point to show that generally speaking, that's an assumed good thing. As it says on your handout, that proposition there, that medicine is part of God's common grace. We were talking this morning about saving grace, God's particular work in Christ. Now, when we say common grace, we mean what God generally does in goodness, out of the goodness of his heart, you might say, to the world, in providing for the world. It shouldn't be used, though, to do anything that God's word contradicts, is my next proposition. And it can be used, though, to relieve suffering and to prolong life. If something we do helps someone live longer, that's not kind of intervening and playing God. That's using God's common grace provision to us in order to save or to prolong life. Medical intervention, though, it's the next bullet point on there. I'm just reading them at this point before I get too rambly. Medical intervention for lifestyle reasons seems to me to be at least much less justified. Acceptable as of unacceptable in the sort of range of things. So let's go for taking paracetamol. Acceptable or unacceptable? Use of God's common grace. Why are you even thinking about it? Acceptable. It's an acceptable use of God's common grace to us. Having surgery to correct some kind of eyesight defect. Brazilian bum lift. The microphone wasn't on. People were listening to the recording and saying, I wonder what they were laughing at. Yeah. So what criteria are you going to use for deciding a Brazilian bum lift is not? Do you know, there's a lot worse. I happened to be listening to Radio 5. Fantastic couple of things at lunchtime this week on Radio 5. One was about polyamorous relationships, which I've got to blog on, because it was a fascinating insight into polyamorous relationships and how the... anyway, I'll spoil my blog, so I won't tell you about that. But it was very interesting insight into a kind of modern view about that. You know, people actually phoning in about polyamorous relationships, meaning, you know, multiple partner relationships. But another day was about cosmetic surgery. And so I learned all about cosmetic surgery while I was eating my peanut butter on toast. With a Brazilian bum lift, you can't sit down for a month, I don't think. But you look good when you stand up. So that's cool. So come on then, Brazilian bum lift, why is that not acceptable? You're all kind of thinking, oh, it's a bit of a laugh, yeah, it's not acceptable. So why is it not acceptable? Or perhaps you're saying it is acceptable, it's a good idea. Pardon? It's vanity. Okay, what about making my nose slightly smaller? It's not going to provide any functional benefit. Okay. Oh, so you've got to be like medically unwell to take medicine. If it doesn't actually change your medical situation, are we putting that forward as a theology?
Yeah, because like, has a boob job opposed to having a mastectomy.
So are we thinking about motivation being pretty important? Are you thinking about motivation being the maybe a significant part of that, exactly why you're doing it? The people on this, it was kind of part phone-in, part discussion, were saying, particularly to do with boob jobs and other things, that almost always the woman doesn't do it because she sort of wants to, in and of herself. Like, you know, she's always wanted. But it's more that there's some kind of cultural pressure or peer pressure or partner pressure going on. I think that was the point of that, which was interesting. I think that was true.
What about putting braces on your kids' teeth?
Quite. Very good point. Putting braces on your kids' teeth.
It helps you eat better.
I think there's a question over whether God designed the body to be like that. He didn't design it.
Yes.
Poison injected.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you can just give them common grace, even if it's just like someone take a pill that I don't know, change some other part of the body, like you should still be wrong. I think it's trying to go against God.
Yeah. Yeah. James, I'm having a bit of microphone now for a moment because you were in reach.
But in as Mark I think was saying, if depression is also a part of the fall and perhaps some augmentation alleviates that, I'm not saying that's the go-to, but it could also, it's still quite grey. It's still, yeah, that it's something that fixes an issue brought about by the fall, but that's quite broad.
Yeah, the only thing with that, sorry.
Yeah. Have a bit of that.
The only thing with that is that you're fixing something that's not actually what the problem is. You're sort of fixing a symptom, and you're actually not sure you're going to fix it with that, because who knows, in 20 years when the silicone implant fails, it's not going to cause more problems. So that it is a difficult issue, but I think in this whole area it's very easy to get very specific. I think it's quite important to keep quite general, otherwise you get down a rabbit hole of one individual that you maybe know or I know. Start discussing their issue, and I think rule of thumb is probably more helpful, I would think, in this.
Yeah, I think that's true. There are lots of other examples, because we're doing the other topic, the narrower topic of IVF, don't want to spend too much longer on that, but it's worth thinking about. You can kind of reach very quick judgments and then realize it's a little bit more complicated, as you're just illustrating. A little bit more complicated than you thought. There are simple relief of symptoms, correction of defects type surgery, and then there's this kind of stuff in between which might be considered lifestyle vanity or might be considered just kind of correcting something that's not really how it should be. And you can kind of argue that backwards and forwards. I think for most of the cosmetic-related surgeries, I think most of them are seeking to alter what you've been kind of genetically given by God, which is not medically defective. That's rather a long way of putting it, but generally you're trying to correct something that you've been given by God that's not sort of medically or functionally defective. I think, you know, crooked tooth to some degree is sort of has a defect to it, because, you know, we're expected to have straight teeth because you can eat better and everything else. So I think it is that's in the area of a kind of medically defective. I think if you've got a massive wart on your face or something, you could say, well, that's, you know, my genetic and environment has kind of led me to that. So, you know, that's what God's given me. I think, you know, getting rid of it, it's not a vanity thing. It's something that's not, you know, in the normal range of things. Whereas the size of various parts of your body kind of are. And you wouldn't go for kind of arm extensions or leg extensions. Treatment for baldness, though, I'm open to that. If anyone wants to you know, gift me a $500,000 and I'll get mine sorted. That wouldn't be vanity, would it? Okay. No, you see that pun? yes. I think it probably would. So let's be honest about it. But, you know, people might make different judgments about how they use the money. So here's the question then. Where does fertility treatment fall in this kind of range of medicine? Acceptable, unacceptable, kind of in general, treating a lack of fertility, the lack of the ability for a man and a woman having sexual intercourse, producing a child from it. If you intervene in that process somewhere, what do you think God thinks about that? Okay. Sorry. It was a good point, so I think you should repeat it. No, because it was...
I'm not saying it's what I think, because I haven't thought about it that much, but based on your definition of if it's a medical defect and by God's design we should be having or able to have children, if it's a medical defect that you can't, then fixing it seemingly isn't an issue.
Okay. Does everyone agree with that? Nobody sort of nodded or shook, so I don't know what that meant.
Is there a question about where the medical intervention comes from? So, I mean, we didn't talk about it with other forms of medicine, but, you know, in any type of medicine, if you come about it from a method that is not considered right, is that part of the question? Because, you know, there are different forms of intervention to help people who have fertility difficulties, but it's for me, it's the conclusion about where that intervention comes from in terms of the medical procedure involved with a fetus. And I guess the same is that with like stem cell treatment and things like that for certain medicines, if they're coming from fetuses and they're using them in medical research, we haven't discussed any of that because that's all in that same bracket.
We're going to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, no, but that's the good general point, though. So anyone just want to say anything high level? Yes, Sarah?
I was thinking culturally it's seen as a right and an expectation, whereas biblically I'm not sure that we would say that it is. Like a God-given right and expectation. But I'm not sure. I'm musing on that as I say it. But I'm increasingly noticing that the pressure is on for anyone who wants a child to be able to have a child by any means.
Yes.
So I think we're in that culture, so that's affecting our thinking.
Yes, that's very helpful. I think there's a difference between right and expectation, actually. I think you can have a reasonable expectation that in God's normal way of operating, you are likely to have children, which is different to saying this is my right. So I know you weren't blurring those, but just to sort of clarify that. In what sense would it be a stewardship issue?
I worked with a person that probably spent $15,000. Yeah. So it's a bit of a stewardship issue because you have to ask yourself, is there a reason why God does not allow me to conceive? And could it be possible God either does not want you to be a parent or does he want you to adopt a child?
Yeah.
Spend the money to adopt rather than spend the money in the hopes that you can conceive, because I guess that's what I think about is just the stewardship of it and the cost of it, which is the wiser decision. Yeah. Spend a lot of money so you can have a child of your own, or spend money to take in a child that was not wanted.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very helpful point. I think that is an issue worth thinking about. I would go with Matthew's point at a high level, which is it's reasonable to expect that children could come along from a relationship that obviously a relationship that God approves of in terms of a man and a woman being married. So that's not an unreasonable expectation. And if there's a defect that could be corrected without breaking any of God's other laws to achieve that. So if you've got a blocked fallopian tube or something, There's lots of things you could do, or if there's, you know, some nuts you could eat that kind of, you know, improve woman's fertility or something, you know, some sort of process like that, or some other technique or something that made it more likely. I think that's all kind of within the category of trying to correct defects that are part of the fall. But then you do get into the area of what Amanda was saying and what you're saying about and what Sarah was saying, which we're going to talk about. Matthew, do you want to add something to that before we move on?
I was going to kind of say similar, which is like we're talking about plastic surgery. Really, it's the whole area of changing your appearance medically, which kind of goes from makeup, but it really goes from setting your teeth straight is medically all the way to making you look like a lion, like some people do, and having their teeth sharpened and stuff, and even more crazy stuff that actually happens. Yeah. And it's the same with this. It can be a medical intervention where someone is told they need to lose weight because it will help them conceive or do more exercise, which is a medical intervention, through to someone, I don't know, having a baby transplanted or something much worse.
Yeah, no, helpful. Thank you. Okay. I don't think I said there's no line, but yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well. Good point. You all enjoyed that, didn't you? Thanks. I could do it again for you. My Brazilian derriere was on show. Oh, man. Thanks very much. Why is there nothing on there? Is it turned off? From when I I think it's not turned on, actually, over there. It's not been working at all, to my knowledge. Is it not turned on over here? That would be better. Yeah, we're on now. That's why I couldn't see it, because it wasn't turned on. And it was black, you know. Just one point, and then we'll...
I think the thing that's wrong with IVF is not the way the baby is conceived, but the fact that they fertilize more eggs and they're only, according to the law, allowed to put, I think it is 3 eggs into the womb, and the other, and they choose the healthiest 3, and the others are disposed of.
This is true, and we're getting onto IVF in just a sec, but I was going kind of high level of the principles before drilling right down to any of the particular treatments. So I think we got there in terms of the principles. So the second thing just to look at, and I think with the time we'll just kind of work through it pretty quick. So we've thought about the theology of medicine. We thought about that, how it applies generally to medical procedures. And we thought about how that applies, again, at a high level to fertility-related treatments. Now let's just think about human life, so the theology of human life. Human life is precious, it says there, and should not be ended for selfish reasons. Genesis 9, verse 6 is the Noah covenant, and that because people... men and women are made in God's image, life should not be taken from them, and there's an obligation on society to protect that right to life that people have, and to punish those who break that. Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments, of course, and it's about do not kill. So that's the right to life in general, that human life is precious, and it comes from us being image bearers, and probably the most famous is Psalm 139, but the other texts are quite helpful if you want to look up them at home as well. I've put Psalm 139 in twice, I noticed that. Psalm 139, what does that teach you about human life, and in particular, human life in the womb? Psalm 139, 13 to 16. Have a look at it. Why don't you have a look at it and have a chat with your neighbour, because you're not coming straight up. So have a quick chat. What does it teach you about human life in the womb? If you're like super quick, you can look at any of the other texts as well. Okay, so what does that text and any of the others, if you had a chance to look at them, what do they teach you about human life prenatal? Anything that teaches you? Made by God. Made by God, so there's a forming of God. A lot of those other texts talk about God forming us in the womb. So there's something of the divine intervention of God creating life each time in each conception. Of course, it's a biological process. God uses means, but there's something particular about God's sovereign purpose in each creation of life. Okay, more. Okay, so yeah, God has a sovereign plan for our life. All our living days are ordained for us. Okay, more about the person in the womb. Okay. Yes, God's active purpose. More about the I'm even like feeling it out to you. That God saw the unformed body as a person. You saw me. I was there in the womb, unformed, my unformed body. There was not yet all the basic organs. There wasn't a formation of the organs. I certainly wasn't breathing. I probably couldn't feel pain. And yet God is referring to me as a me. I'm a me. I was an I then. Why are you frowning, Caroline? Was that not true? Okay. Fair enough. Good point. Don't be sorry. You're good. Very good. Yes. It was not good for this man to be alone anyway. So it's really important to understand that as far as we can perceive, now, and you can stretch the language too far, but as far as we can understand it, there was a personhood to the unformed bodies of various people. Job talks in similar language. There's a kind of a person identity attributed to John the Baptist as he leaps in the womb, having seen Mary, when Mary goes to visit Elizabeth. So if you take that all together, the Jeremiah text is about the commissioning of Jeremiah, that even before he was born, God had a plan for him. But it also talks in terms of him as a person being formed in the womb. So, in as much as we can understand anything, because there are some mysteries to this still, and we can think about those, but as much as we can understand anything, the creation of life in the womb forms a person. And we know from the rest of the Bible that a person should not be destroyed for selfish reasons. We know that from the rest of the Bible that they have this, that they're image bearers and should not be murdered. So that must mean, by definition, that the person inside the womb should not be murdered. Does that make sense? We're all with that general kind of principle. So we thought about medicine. We thought about murder. Just a moment, and again, I apologize to my Tuesday group, but just a moment on the autonomous self, just to think about that for a moment, that you can listen online for the first two autumn schools, which talk about this in a bit more detail, but modern thinking is quite influenced by the idea that we separate the person from the body. And the person is a distinct thing with rights and identity, and the body is a kind of a secondary thing that's a kind of just a repository for that, which is just a bunch of cells. So if you Google, as I told my group on the Tuesday before last, personhood theory, you can see lots of academic papers and discussion about this. The idea of separating the idea of person from body. It's not the same as the Christian idea of the soul that is intricately connected to the body. It's not that Christian idea. It's the idea of this person that's pretty much independent of the body. And of course, it gives rise to lots of things that's happening in modern culture where you separate the person from the body, so the person can be a different gender and so forth, because the person is not connected to the body. And related to that, there is the idea that we can, as a culture, like as a community, decide when a set of cells becomes a person. So that's a kind of cultural construction. So we can say a single cell is not a person, a double cell is not a person. When it's become sort of a million cells, not necessarily a person, it depends what attributes it has. And then eventually we decide that there's enough inside going on that we can give it the great honor of being person. And then it has some rights. Who knows how long those rights will stay, but for the moment in our culture, a person has some rights, the right to life and so on. So that is a cultural tide. It's not always expressed in that way, it's not always thought through in that way, but it is pretty much behind a lot of the ideas, including the one that we're looking at this evening. The person has moral and legal rights and responsibilities. The body is just a bunch of cells. It's expendable. Actually, how you use the body is entirely determined by the person. There's no moral right way to use a particular body. So you can basically do what you like with it as long as the person's rights are being upheld. So that's the idea, which works towards certain practices, but it also kind of underpins some ideas about abortion and about lots of other things, including IVF. Does that make sense, or are there any questions on that before we move on? No? Okay. So let's think about assistive reproductive technology, which would include IVF. Just to save me saying them, do you want to tell me some of the technologies available under the general category of assistive reproductive technology? What are some of the therapies? What are some of the treatments? What stuff is available? Pardon? Sperm bank is a possibility. That is, from on your handout, artificial insemination by donor. Artificial insemination by husband is the other one. Sorry, I just finished that. Yes, surrogates is another thing. We're going to think about surrogates in just a moment. So various surrogate options. And there are a few.
They're increasingly pushing egg harvesting for young women to allegedly be able to have fertilized by the person later implanting. This is now a benefit from Google and various other companies.
Yes. Yes, it would generally evolve, though. It would be under the general category of IVF because it would be fertilization outside of the womb. In a glass, fertilization is what IVF is about, in a test tube. Yes, yeah. 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 So there's the whole range of IVF. So there's that one, but there's just the sort of classic IVF, which is a man and a woman at this point, although when we look at cloning, it doesn't have to be. But a man and a woman providing the two parts, sperms and eggs, and having a number of those fertilized and then a selection of those implanted in a woman. So lots of options. It could include surrogacy in that, but just assuming it's just a man and the woman, then implanting in the woman who's part of that couple. It just mentioned on the handouts, just because I found it, but I don't really understand it, a couple of methods there. Intracytoplasmic sperm injection and gamete intrafallopian transfer, which is obviously some process that goes on within the woman. And then there's surrogacy. And within surrogacy, there's two main options, really, which is surrogacy using the eggs of the surrogate. So it's pretty much the kind of bad Old Testament idea of having sex with your handmaid or something. It's in that kind of category where you've got the eggs from the surrogate woman who says, yeah, I'll have a child for you. I've got loads of eggs. And often, if it's kind of medically controlled, often it's through the introduction of sperm rather than actually these two guys having sex that the sperm's introduced, but it can be either way. And then the surrogate obviously gets pregnant and bears a child which is related to the father but not the mother, but it becomes their child. There are other methods where the let's call them husband and wife just for ease, but the husband and wife provide a set of fertilized eggs which are their DNA, but then that's implanted in the woman. So she's giving a surrogate womb rather than a surrogate womb plus eggs. That makes sense? There's two kind of main kinds of surrogacy. So those are some of the technologies, so I had to go through that little bit of detail. So what do you think the Bible condemns, is silent about, or supports? And what reasons might you give for that? So, condemns, silent about, supports, what you'd say? Give yourself another 5 minutes, talk with your neighbor. Oh. Thank you. You look too cheerful to be talking about the topic. Okay. Okay, I'm really sorry, but just to keep us rolling on time, it'd be good to just gather our thoughts and speak together a little bit. I've got some propositions that are on the handout, but just talk to me about what you think the Bible might condemn or justify or be silent about and leave us some area for making our own judgments about. Anybody?
Anything that results in the biblical definition of life being destroyed.
It's working out. Anything that results in the biblical definition of life being destroyed?
Yes.
Cool.
Is condemned, do you think? Yes. Okay.
Anything that goes very obviously against God's plan for marriage, I think.
Okay. Anything that goes against God's, that's a important, also further qualifier. Thank you. Go on, Henry, you can do it.
That's why Matt's taking this one.
Yeah, this is from our group discussions, but basically there are probably a couple of areas which are less morally clear, and that would be IVF. Apparently Christians can request that there is no destruction of embryos, and so they use only what they've fertilised. So that's a question which we didn't really answer, but we're saying that's different. And then does that mean that surrogacy, where they take the husband and wife's thing and do the IVF thing, and so they don't do any destruction, and then implant it into a third-party womb, which is the other woman, is that right? I mean, that's kind of, you cut us off just before we answered that. So, tough.
Yeah, okay. That's a really hard question to answer. When we talk about the biblical definition of life, then, that's condemned, what about life outside the womb? So you got 1,000 fertilized eggs outside the womb. Biblical life, as God defines it? Pardon? I love the way you said that. No? I just said outside the womb. Okay. So you can kill it then. I'm asking you. Yeah.
That would never happen. Are those embryos before they're implanted? Are they human?
That could be a better way of asking it, but yeah, it's the same question. Yeah. Are those embryos that are created, so a couple want to create some fertilized embryos for implantation, they're outside of the womb. Are they life by God's definition? I would say so. Not every Christian would say that. To be fair, not every Christian would say that. I get it. The bun in the oven analogy for pregnancy. I get it. Sure. Yes. Yes. No, but the reason I think that the argument becomes grey is quite your point, really. But the only thing that's stopping that become a fully fledged human is environmental, not structural. It's not fundamental to this fertilized embryo that it won't make it because it needs something else to happen. It's entirely environment from then on, which is an interesting thought. but yeah, it's entirely environment from that point. It's not to do with it needs some injection of something else to make it happen. It's entirely environmental. So I think that's why the argument tends to lean more towards, yes, it is a unique piece of DNA. Be quick, Matthew, because we've got to move fairly quick. No, you're right.
It's whether God has made that person at that point or not, not whether a human has put it into someone's womb. And as we saw, David is knit together by God. And so if when there's an embryo formed, however small, that's when God gives life, soul, meaning, purpose, future, everything. Yes. And it's always been up to man to end life early. And by not implanting it, you're just ending it very early. Yeah. The question is that when life has begun? Has God given that person
yes.
life? And I would say he has. Otherwise, when does it happen?
Yeah, quite. I think that's exactly so, that if you say, well, you just need to be put in the right environment, then you can argue that for quite a long time. You can say, well, what if the environment collapses for the woman? You know, it's okay to then kill the baby, you know, if there's a problem with the woman. Yeah.
Are those cells put together by God when they've been forced together by humans?
Well, this is an interesting question. Which is even harder to work out. I think it's extremely hard, by the way, to find. People say, you know, as Christians, you can ask for a single fertilization. It's very, very hard, in my observation and discussion with people, to actually get anyone who would agree to do that because of the expense involved and the likelihood a number of them will die. So whatever you're sort of told, it's highly likely that more than one egg will be fertilized. But let's just assume for a moment that it is. There's another question then to say that you're so outside of God's natural process for creating it. Is that okay? And that would be the same argument, I think, for surrogacy. You could say, well, genetically it's coming from the man and the woman, but the whole experience is outside of God's normal economy. So I think it raises some questions. There was a hand, Nathan?
Or that God's design is that a sperm and egg come together, and there's nothing that people are doing in a different way to that to bring about life, other than when you get onto cloning. But everything that involves new life is a sperm and egg at the start, and that's God's design, and therefore, however it happens, it's life.
That could be the counter argument, and that's why people might say that. Well, I think God uses means, so I'm not even sure I could extract God from the process, however it happens. I don't think you're forcing something to happen. I'm just saying there are questions. The further and further you get away from God's design for how children are conceived and the whole experience, which is the experience of both sexual intercourse and intimacy, creating a child carried by the woman who's the mother. The further and further you get away from that, I think the more questionable it becomes. Now, that's not to say every child has to be genetically connected with their parents, because, you know, as we'll think about in just a moment, to do with adoption. Adoption's a brilliant thing. By the way, you have to think about Jesus' conception as well when you think about this, just to kind of put it in there, to think... not that it was by IVF or anything like that, but to say that, you know, God can intervene in, obviously, in a miraculous way to knit together a set of DNA which will produce, perfectly normal, not perfectly formed man, because he was just the same as us, but a perfectly normal set of biological material. So God can do that, but I think that's the exception. Sorry, Dave.
We were discussing that there is a lot of chaos, but there's also a lot of order in that chaos. And there are certain things that seem to be almost broken by design in our fallen world. And that came of me saying, without going into specificity because of recording and whatnot, yeah. My sample size is tiny and there's a lot of subjectivity and it's very specific. But I know somebody who they couldn't conceive.
Yes.
People, not someone.
Yes.
And they went through IVF, they went through a lot of treatment, and they finally did. But the issues that they had with the baby once it had come, she's grown up now, yeah. But it led him to question whether or not there was a reason they conceived in the first instance because of that,
yeah.
Because of the issues that came after birth.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. Let me make a few propositions, then you can always come back round on them. Psalm 127 says, children are a blessing from the Lord. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. The idea of what you put your arrows in behind your back. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, children born in one's youth. Which is another interesting point. That a lot of fertility issues are not to do with people who marry late. Because, you know, obviously that's what happened. It's not to do with that. It's sometimes to do with that, but it's mostly to do with people who commit late and want to kind of pursue careers and stuff first. So a lot of fertility issues to do with people who are older than is the optimum time to conceive. Interesting point. blessed are those children born in one's youth. That's what it says there. I'm just saying, that's what it says. So that is something to think about have you made a whole series of life choices that mean now at this point it's very hard for you to conceive? This is a consequence of a whole cultural drift towards aging parenthood for all kinds of reasons. Late commitment, late marriage, late decision to have children because you want to follow a career first. There are a whole load of contributing factors that you're then trying to rein back by chemicals, basically. So because you've been reining it back by chemicals before then. So that's certainly something to think about. So, children are a blessing. God is sovereign in fertility. Clearly, we get that in the birth of Jesus. We get that in the barrenness of various people. Hannah in the Old Testament, Elizabeth in the New Testament, Sarah before she conceived with Abraham and so on. So, lots of sovereign interventions in both not having children and being able to have children. I'm not saying from that you just say, well, this is God's sovereign purpose, but it's worth thinking about. Do we run to medicine first or do we run to prayer first and to seek God first in these things? It's a really good question. Is that what you do if you couldn't conceive? I've got to get a doctor's appointment. Maybe you need to get a prayer appointment. So because God is sovereign, we need to think about that. Not having children is very painful, though, and to not have them is not wrong. To be sad at not having them is not wrong, but they're not right, as Sarah was saying, and they can become an idol to us. Let me just throw out a few more things, and then you might want to comment on it. Here's something: children as a laboratory product are something I think different certainly in creation than children conceived what you might call naturally, different from the procreative act of married union within this profound, deep relationship between a man and a woman. Something that's fertilized over here, it's a different process, isn't it? We could say, well, it's the same process biologically, but it ain't the same process emotionally, is it? So it's worth thinking about that because it's a different process. If you just think biology, well, it's the same, doesn't matter. If you think emotionally, spiritually, union-wise, covenantally, it's a different process. So that at least starts to raise questions, even if it doesn't say it's completely wrong. It starts to raise questions about that. We've already decided that... Well, no, I'll come back to that in a minute. As many as one in six couples... are considered to be infertile. It's not the answer, but there are lots of opportunities for adoption for those. And we wouldn't say that anyone has a right to children. Artificial insemination by the husband seems to me to be a reasonable proposition. In that you're just aiding a natural process. All of the possible treatments that improve fertility or intervene in some other way seem to be reasonable in that sense. In vitro fertilization, IVF, seems to me at least to have a number of issues associated with it. And you kind of said them already, but just to kind of list them out, they're on the second page of the handout, which are, there's a kind of stewardship question, which is, There's a very poor success rate, about 20% on average, and it gets much worse the older you get, significantly worse. That's true of conceiving in general, but it's like multiplied to do with in vitro fertilization. If you're in your 20s, I think it's like 40%. Then it gets worse in your 30s. When you get beyond your 40s, it's a very low percentage. I think in your 40s, it's 2% chance, something like that. It's that order of magnitude. So it's a very statistically unlikely to succeed, procedure, which carries an awful lot of emotional freight with it. So it's not like, you know, take a pill, have an injection, job done. There's a whole load of emotional experience that goes with it, and it's a question of whether that is you know, useful and helpful. There's high costs, various estimates, but thousands of pounds per cycle. So there's the financial cost and there's the psychological costs. There is, with the whole process, the problem of multiple pregnancies and kind of how you deal with them, whether you're ready for them, or whether you just get rid of some of them because you don't want to cope with them. Yes, indeed. But, you know, even more than two sometimes. And along with that, you get, through the process, the possibility of all kinds of immoral unions that create these babies. So, you know, grandmothers giving birth to their grandchildren is possible. Because, you know, depending on who you're using for donating and so forth, or whether you stored embryos, there's all kinds of weird moral outcomes that you can have, things that are completely, it would seem, sort of unnatural. So I'm a woman, and I can't conceive, but that's okay. My grandmother had her eggs stored, so I'll have those fertilized by my husband, and we'll have some children from that. You know, that's entirely possible, isn't it? But then you get a complete breaking of the human relational connection to the child and the DNA to do with that. Now, it's not everything, because we've got to think about adoption and those sort of things, but it certainly creates weird moral connections and dilemmas. And it also breaks with God's sovereignty, I think, to do with menopause. So you can have postmenopausal babies, can't you? But by this process, you know, is that okay? You really are kind of trying to break into it to what God has said, and it's not really a natural defect, is it? Menopause, it's kind of a natural process, not an unnatural defect. You would say, or would you say it's all right? You know, let's reverse the menopause, and you know, if I'm healthy enough, let's have children at 60 or whatever. But you've got to think why you think that's wrong. You know, you're looking like, well, I wouldn't want to do that. But you've got to think kind of why that's wrong. Is it a breaking of God's sovereignty and God's natural plan for things wrong? Or, you know, for some other reasons. But I think it is not good. Let me finish on IVF and then we'll allow for any comments on that. Let's get to the core problem to do with IVF, because I've kind of gone all around some of the related issues, which might be a reason, for kind of humanly speaking, for discarding it. The core problem is, as Linda said earlier, the spare embryos are stored or destroyed. About 9 out of every 10 embryos is destroyed. Fertilized embryos is destroyed in the process. So I think that's one fundamental reason why the normal process of IVF is wrong, and the normal process is multiple fertilizations going on. So I think for that reason it's wrong. For the reason that it takes conception outside of the natural order of the sexual union between a man and a woman in the covenant relationship of marriage, I think it's wrong for that reason too. And I think it's wrong in the sense of what it creates, which is the impression, the idea that embryos are not just, are just a bunch of cells, which are a commodity. It really does go towards, and particularly to do with surrogacy and so forth, it goes towards the commodification, is the word, of children. And I would say there's lots of questions, similar questions about surrogacy. Even if the surrogate mother is carrying a fertilized egg which belongs to the two parents, I think it's a commodifying process. It's a process of turning it into just a kind of a lump of biological material that's kind of owned and can be used at will, implanted at will, discarded at will, Even the surrogacy process probably has lots of eggs that are killed off in the process and so forth. Because of time, we're not going to look at the next question, which is about donating or selling sperm. It's the same thing, donating or selling sperm. I should have said eggs as well. But there's a whole, and particularly in other countries, but there's a whole commercial process going on with kind of commodifying children in the sense of conceived eggs, but also the sperm and the eggs. I don't think as a Christian it would be right to donate eggs or to donate sperm, however hard up you are. I think there's a moral transgression that you do in doing that, because you're breaking the combination of the DNA material that God has decreed to be happening within the union of a man and a woman. You're breaking out of that, and you're just saying this is a piece of biological material, my sperm or my eggs, and I can just sell it at will. I think it's a wrong process. You might not agree with me, but I think it is wrong. Do you think it's wrong? Okay. One last thing, and then you can make a few comments, and then cloning we'll do real quick, because I think it's in a sense more straightforward but more scary. Some of you may have been involved in IVF. Some of you have obviously got friends who have made choices. Some of your friends may be Christians who've made those kind of choices. They've thought about a different definition, perhaps, when life begins. Christians might, I didn't give you the opportunity to say, but when you were thinking about how Christians might justify it, they might say, life begins when the baby becomes viable. I don't think that's how God defines it. You might say, life begins when the egg is implanted in the womb and starts to divide. Some people would argue that. I understand that argument. I think in these things, I would adopt the precautionary principle, which is, I don't really know. I don't know how the soul and the body come together. But because I don't know, I don't want to interfere. Does that make sense? I don't really know. You know, if God kind of, you know, took us to be with him in glory, and we asked the question, well, when did the soul begin? You know, how did it develop with the body? And he kind of explains, you know, and said, well, actually, it was 12 weeks after him, we say, but we didn't know. So I think there's a kind of precautionary principle that says it seems that the two live together. It seems like the soul begins with the body, that the soul and body are kind of there at the beginning. That's the most obvious reading of all the scriptures. So we go with that. We're cautious about doing anything else. That's the principle I would adopt. Just to be cautious, because we don't quite know how that process all goes on. This biological material, there's a whole load of test tubes, and clearly they're not going to be babies if they're just kind of washed down the toilet at the end of it. Clearly they can't be babies, and you know, what does God think of that? Are all those kind of test tube babies in heaven, and all those kind of things to think about? I don't know. But I think my precautionary principle is I don't even want to have the question because I think we're commodifying and taking the whole thing out of God's hands. However, that was my digression. However a child is conceived, whether it's through one of these processes that we're not happy with from what we're talking about tonight, and we don't feel that it's God's plan, we have to know that God is sovereign, even in those things. Now, I know you won't, but just to kind of say it out loud, children that are the product of an adulterous relationship, we don't look down on those children and say they're substandard because they're that, do we? You know, children that are the product of an affair, children that are product of any sexual immorality, children that are a product of IVF, we don't ever want to look down them and say they're less precious in God's sight. So although we may want to think really carefully about the process and the damage that process caused, we need to make sure that we are as generous as God is and as dignifying as God is in allowing that human being created by whatever process to be respected as someone made in God's image. You okay with that? I think it's important because, you know, you can kind of reach your conclusions and you haven't had the moral dilemmas and you've had children and everything else, and you can be, I think it's right to be judgmental in the sense of having a view and taking a view, but it can lead to a sort of snobbery about children created in that process, which we absolutely need to avoid. Anyone want to say anything before we talk about cloning? Yes, Colin.
about it, but I think it, the principle sort of informs very strongly how you would feel about continuing to try to have children after a number of miscarriages.
Yes.
And it has affected Christians that I know.
Yes.
Both deciding both sides of that difficult decision.
Yes.
So yeah. I don't know, really know how I feel about it either.
Just no.
The principle affects it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think... The further it gets into the area that we become much clearer that we're killing people, I think we need to be more strident on. The further away from that, where issues become a little bit harder to determine, there has to be some degree of generosity of spirit. We, you know, we say what we think, and I know that's not quite what you're saying, but I think that's true to do with the process. I think it's also to do with trying to read God's providence is hard in the sense of, does the fact that I've had three miscarriages mean that God doesn't want me to have children? I'm not sure I can say that, but we may need to take medical advice that informs that in some way, but I don't think kind of just by the statistic we say God means we don't have children. It may be that God is just testing our faith and our resolve and our prayer and our trust in him, but it may be that we're not to have children. But I don't think God guides us in that way necessarily. But I still come back to the point that the more we try and break out of the natural order of things, the more we are really kind of, the more we need to question, are we pushing against God's providence? We need to at least question that. I think trying to conceive naturally and having a number of miscarriages is not trying to break out of that. whereas, you know, persisting endlessly with some other process seems to me to be breaking out of that. Oh, yes?
So Mary didn't... could she be classed as like a surrogate then? Because she didn't, that she conceived. Not
I'm with you, yeah. I think that might be a word that you might use, but I don't think it's a particularly a useful word, but yeah. Virgin birth. So I don't think she was a surrogate in the sense that she had an egg that was... fertilized by a man, so I don't think the surrogate in the way that we use the word would be the word, but in a very broad sense of the use of that word in English, it's kind of a word that you might want to use. Simple thing is, Mary is a one-off, isn't she? She's a one-off in the whole of the history of mankind. So other people in the Bible who couldn't conceive and then could conceive, that's just the grace of God in allowing the natural process to that was stopped to restart. What's produced in Mary is a one-off, so I don't think we could build a theology of anything. I threw it in there just to say, you just need to be careful and think, okay, what do you think about that? And I think you have to think, this is a unique one-off process where God intervenes in history to change the natural order of things. So I'd call it a miracle rather than a surrogacy. Yes. Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's helpful, yeah, yeah. She is, yeah. But it's also true that surrogacy in the broadest sense can be the egg coming from the mother. Yes, surrogacy can be an egg from a man and woman implanted, but it also can be the egg from that woman used with the man's sperm. So that's what I'm saying. That, you know, in a very broad sense. I'm just not sure it's a helpful term to use, but it's no, okay. Because it puts you in that sort of, you know, general category rather than the miracle category. I'm really going to move on to cloning because I'm really going to stop in 5 minutes. Here we go. Oh, yeah. I am, because it's really rather simple in a way. Simple but scary. Okay, there's two main methods of cloning. There's cloning using somatic cell nuclear transfer, which of course you know all about. And I did understand it actually, which is you've got a cell. You all know from your biology lessons that a cell's got a nucleus, and then it's got the kind of the rest of the stuff, all the blubby stuff all around it, and the nucleus controls that. So you get rid of the nucleus from this cell, and you get the nuclear material from something else, some other cell, and then you put it into there, by that way you've created a clone that's basically, so if you know the nucleus is in my cells, I've got my DNA. So if I take one of my nucleuses and put it in the cell of some, well, it doesn't matter who else, but somebody else, that cell, this embryo cell, then becomes a clone of me, because its basic command and control center is from me. Its basic DNA control is coming from me. So it's a clone of me. Which, even if I said nothing else, would be scary, wouldn't it? So cloning using that method is one method. And the other method is embryo splitting, which is the natural process of twinning, but it's making that happen. So you've got an embryo, and you force it to split and divide away. So you've got genetically identical cells then starting to grow, like you do for twins. But it's not happening naturally. It's happening in a forced way. You make that happen. I think for humans, the best you can do is four. I think for rats you can do more, but I think for humans you can create four from one before it becomes dangerous or something. So those are the two methods for cloning. The reason for cloning, the one that's advanced much more is therapeutic, which is that these cells, these embryo cells, they could obviously develop into human beings. Legally, that's not allowed in this country at the moment. But they can also develop into 100 other cell types. So your main cell types in your body, you know, your brain type, muscle type, all those kind of things. So if you want to repair something, if you want to create some genetically suitable brain cells for me, you clone some stuff over here using my nucleuses or the other process, and you then harvest those. You make them turn into brain cells, this embryo. You make it turn into brain cells, and then you grab the brain cells and stick them back in me. So you can see the basic therapeutic process. You create from this kind of origination DNA identical material that you can then stick back into me, the donor. So that's the therapeutic reason. That's what everyone gets excited about. That's the kind of justification for it. The second reason is the more sinister one, which is a reproductive reason, which is copying yourself or someone you want to replicate. Supposing you're worried that your child might die, you want a replica of them, so you create a replica. Or there was I'm tipping over that now. Or there was a favorite grandmother, and you'd really like her to kind of relive her life. So you get her to relive through someone else. And you're looking horrified, but it's entirely what's plausible from this. So those are the reproductive reasons. Or creating surrogates, which is more the justification of having a genetic connection to parents. So it's entirely possible, if you create the right combination of material, that you have a sort of multi-DNA fruitcake thing where you harvest DNA from the two same-sex parents, for example, to create a child that has DNA material from both of them. Possibly some other stuff thrown in to make it work as well, but it will have a genetic connection with both the same-sex parents. I don't know if you realize that. I didn't really think that through beforehand. Yes? Any reproductive cloning is illegal in this country. What most Christian kind of writers on this think is that you can get it done abroad, and that there is stuff going on. But it's not, the technology is not quite advanced enough to make all those things happen, but there are kind of sales being shipped abroad for that kind of stuff to happen. So those are the two kind of reasons. It's worth saying that since 1970s, 1980s, where this first started getting talked about, and then the famous Dolly the Sheep, that the therapeutic reason doesn't really exist anymore. There's much cheaper ways of producing stem cells. It was discovered that cells that could then become any other kind of cells exist naturally in bodies. So you can harvest, reproduce brain cells, muscle cells, liver cells, or whatever, from other cells in your body. You don't need a cloned embryo or cloned embryo to create the stem cells that then can create these things. So, yeah, that whole thing has gone. Yeah, you can harvest from there and various other places. So that whole thing has gone away as an absolute justification. And actually, I think it's more expensive doing the kind of embryo cloning thing. But still, it's kind of still put forward as a reason, because I think the ultimate goal is actually to do the reproductive cloning. So that's, so I've got a bit more information on here. Yeah. Think about what's wrong with it from God's point of view, what I think is wrong with it. I think, again, it comes into this breaking out of God's design for children conceived within covenantal marriages between a man and a woman. It basically creates something that's not conceived with the marriage union of a man and woman. It's conceived by some other chemical process, pretty much not connected at all with the relationship between a man and a woman. So it's a further extension. If you thought IVF was kind of outside of the covenant, this is well outside the covenant, isn't it? It's creating it from no covenant process. So it's outside of the process that I think God has designed and commanded us for conception. And actually, it will create an industry that is very discriminatory, because inevitably the rich and powerful will control this market, and that you would need to be rich in order to be able to get this. So it will start to make life and children even more so than IVF. It's bad enough with IVF with the monies involved, but with the monies involved in this and the control of the market, which will be by the rich and the powerful. This will mean that the rich can have their designer babies and the perfect sex and the perfect characteristics they want, and the poor won't. So it's from any point of view, from any moral point of view, from any Christian point of view, from any common sense point of view, is a frightening prospect, because it won't create loads of beautiful designer babies and a beautiful world. It will create a world that is given over by God, I think, to a sinful, almost dictatorship of actually the rich controlling the means of reproduction. I think that's what will happen. God grant that doesn't happen. So that's what I think about cloning. if that helps at all, any questions about cloning? Come on, it's 8 o'clock. I'm nearly there. Yes? Yeah. And I think in talking to our friends about this, Christian or non-Christian, just as I keep saying, we need to be really sensitive to experiences they've gone through and decisions they've made. We really can use, I think, the general moral arguments, what you might call the natural law arguments. I think it's reasonable to point out the likely consequences of these things. But I think positively, to keep emphasizing that God values every human being, and make that the kind of the main thing that we keep talking about, that God values every human being made in his image, and that it's because we love people that we have views on this, and that's why we're trying to talk to our friends about it, Christian or non-Christian. Why don't I pray, so those of you who need to go can go, and then if anyone's got any kind of questions or wants to make some further comments about this, talk to me. But other than that, we'll pray, and then we can start to pack up. Let's pray. Gracious Father, we're sorry to hear about these things. We're sad to think how we want to have just what we want and not really think about your plans and your guidance. We pray that you would give us great wisdom in both deciding these things for ourselves, but also how we speak to other people about them, that we might speak with sensitivity and care, but also love for people and love for you. It will perhaps get harder to talk about this, and there's a possibility we upset people who have the heartache and the agony of not being able to conceive and find us cold and unfeeling. Lord, please give us the right words in those kind of difficult conversations that we might speak with balance, but with clarity and love. Have mercy on our world. We pray that you would pull us back from the edge of the precipice. Lord, we pray that there'll be such a revival and love for the gospel that we were thinking about this morning, that so many people are turning to Christ and finding their satisfaction and contentment in him, not in having children, that they're willing to live under your rule and your plans for life and for marriage. Lord, have mercy on us, we pray. Continue with us now as we think about these things, for Christ our Saviour's sake. Amen. 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 Thanks for all your contributions and chatting.